Border Patrol, and he was right. He got right through. Then John stumbled up to the Border Patrol counter. He also went through in a breeze. I'm like, dude, if they let John through, I was pretty sure I was in good shape. The stern Border Patrol lady signaled me over, and I promptly handed her my driver's license. She scanned my license. Are you an American citizen? Yes. I replied exactly how Ian had told me, except I was too drunk to remember one minor detail. I wasn't an American citizen. Unlike Ian, I was an immigrant, a permanent resident with a green card. Oops. The agent typed something into her computer, and she stopped. She studied me for a long beat. Then without saying a word, she got up and whispered something to the armed guard next to her. The guard looked square into my soul and marched two steps towards me. Come with me, sir. The man with the assault rifle led me down a long, empty concrete tunnel to a small, empty room. It had a wooden desk, two metal chairs, and a blinding LED light on the ceiling. He stood in one corner with both of his hands clutching his assault rifle. He said, "Have a seat." I sat down on the cold metal folding chair in front of the heavy wooden desk. I sat there for 30 minutes, and the guard never took his eyes off of me. Finally, the border agent who had checked my ID entered the room. She shut the door behind her and sat down across from me. She cut to the chase. "So, why did you lie?"
I don't.
I was so nervous I could barely form a sentence. "Why did you lie about being an American citizen?"
I'm so sorry.
That's what my friend told me to say. I'm so sorry.
Your friend told you to lie?
No, but he said he just shows his driver's license and says he's an American citizen, and he told me to do the same.
Well, is he an American citizen?
Yes.
Well, are you?
No. She looked over to the guard and had no further questions. I pleaded, "I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to lie. I just didn't think about it. I was going out in Tijuana and I was a bit drunk. I just did what my friend said he does when he crosses the border. I'm so sorry, ma'am. I'm just a stupid college student."
She didn't respond.
She got up and left the room, leaving me alone once again with the armed guard. This time, I was sure I was going to get executed by his assault rifle. Another 30 minutes passed by, and surprisingly, I was still alive. I had lost all hope of ever seeing my family and my friends in the United States again. I was contemplating my last words. I thought about where I'll live when I get deported, where I'll go to school, and how I'll survive on my own in Hong Kong, China, or wherever they were going to send me. Maybe they were calling me an Uber to Guantanamo Bay. But mostly, I thought about how disappointed my parents would be in their idiot son who got drunk in Tijuana and lied to a Border Patrol agent. Then the door swung open and the Border Patrol lady came in again, holding a stack of paperwork. This time, she was accompanied by two other Border Patrol agents, a Latino man and a middle-aged Asian man. I was ready for them to seal my fate as all three of them looked at me in utter disappointment. The lady put the paperwork in front of me and said, "You're lucky this time. I'm going to put down that you forgot your green card, and we won't charge you with anything or put anything on your record." The gods took mercy on me. I lived to American another day. Then the Latino agent said, "There is a fee for not having your green card at the border. Pay that and you can go." I looked down at the paperwork. The fee was $360. Basically my entire college checking account. "Hey, actually, can you guys just like deport me instead?" But I sobered up enough to know that this was one of the best deals I'd ever gotten in my life. So I gladly paid the fee and thanked the lady for her mercy. As the guard ushered me out of the room, the Asian Border Patrol officer said one last thing to me that I'll never forget. "Don't do that again, or we'll send you back to where you came from." Those words shook me to my bones. I felt like the lost 13-year-old foreigner again. All the Pledge of Allegiances, American football, and BET Rap City didn't change anything. I was still just a foreigner living in America. And worst of all, this came from an Asian American person. I was angry. I was angry that an Asian brother sold me out. I was angry that he thought he was better than me. And I was angry that no matter how hard I tried, I was still just a foreigner. I couldn't come up with a response that wouldn't send me to prison. So I just took the comment and silently walked out. I was still nothing more than an immigrant who could be deported at any time. A young stoner living in a retirement community. I was depressed when I went home that summer after freshman year. I was back at square one of my immigrant journey, and I learned nothing in school other than how to roll a joint. I stayed with my dad, who had moved into a retirement community in Monterey Park filled with old Chinese people. I was a long-haired college boy living in a 65 and older apartment complex. People looked at me like I was some kind of alien invading their morning Tai Chi class. I tried being friendly with our neighbors, but they weren't having it. I greeted our 80-year-old Chinese neighbor with a warm smile. "Hi, how are you?" No response. He just stared at me. I tried again in Mandarin. "Ni hao." Still no response. He judgmentally looked me up and down and walked away. Boy, this was going to be a bleak summer. There was a community bench outside of my bedroom. Every day at 7 a.m., I'll wake up to old ladies chatting in Mandarin. An old lady said to her friend, "When did you stop getting your period?" "I was 39. It was early," her friend responded in a matter-of-fact manner. "I stopped getting mine when I was 54. And that was the day I learned about menopause. I didn't have a car, and all my friends from Beverly Hills High lived 20 miles away. I went from the general population in college to solitary confinement in a Chinese retirement community where old ladies were talking about their fucking periods. I felt like I was trapped on a leper island, quarantined from the world. I would go down to the park across the apartment and sit alone on the bench just to get away from my life for a while. One day, as if it was a sign from God, a Latino kid riding a BMX bicycle stopped by the bench I was sitting on. "Yo, you smoke weed?" he asked me. My long hair signaled for weed dealers like the bat signal call for Batman. I said, "Yeah, you got some?" And he pulled out a joint. "You smoke chewy?" I had no idea what chewy meant, but any weed would do at this point. "Sure." And we lit up the joint right there in the park. After a couple of hits, I started coughing like a real amateur. "Oh, man. Oh, this is strong. You never smoked chewy before, huh?" "No, I don't believe so. What is it?" "It's weed with cocaine sprinkled on it." My eyes went wide. I'm sure it was a combination of shock and the cocaine coursing down my bloodstream. He made cocaine sound like an ice cream topping. I'd never done coke before, and I just smoked it in a joint with a random dude on a bicycle in a park across from my dad's retiree apartment. I panicked. "I gotta go." I got up and speed walked home in an effort to sober up. I couldn't throw up something I smoked, and I couldn't wash it down either. So I just laid in my bed with my heart pounding faster than Floyd Mayweather hitting a speed bag. I didn't know what a panic attack was at the time. I thought I was having a full-blown heart attack. My dad was watching TV in his bedroom. No idea his dipshit son just smoked a cocaine-laced joint. I had a decision to make. Should I wait it out and hope my heart doesn't blow out of my chest? Or should I tell my dad I did some cocaine so he can take me to the hospital? The first choice could mean death, but the second choice would come with a lifetime of shame. So as a proper Asian, I chose death over shame. I hopped into the shower to try to calm myself down. I took a 45-minute shower, twice, and my heart was still jumping out of my throat. I lay down on the couch and turned on SportsCenter and ESPN. The familiar voices of Stan Verrett and Neil Everett eased my panic, and I started to doze off. I gave myself a 50-50 chance of waking up, scared to my core that I'll sleep forever. When I did manage to wake up the next morning, I wasn't sure if I was still living or I'd gone to hell where the TV is permanently stuck on ESPN, Or actually, I could argue that would be heaven for me. I started praying to Jesus after that near-death experience. Lord, thank you for saving me from smoking chewy. That's a joint laced with cocaine in case you've never heard of it. I felt my life was going down even steeper spiral. When I went back to school, I spent most of my sophomore year locked inside of my room trying to not die again. I needed to do something drastic to snap out of this slump. Foreign exchange student. In my junior year at UCSD, I moved into an apartment in San Diego with my high school friends Phil from the lunch table, who also went to UCSD, and our mutual friend Bobby, who also went to Beverly Hills High School. Bobby's specialty was peer pressure. Whenever I didn't want to go out with him, he'll put on a full court press. Come on, Jimmy. Don't be a pussy. Jimmy, come on, man. Why are you being like that? And he wouldn't stop until I went out with him. It was annoying at times, but I desperately needed someone like Bobby to pull me out of my funk. One day, Bobby threw out a grandiose idea. Jimmy, let's go study abroad in Italy. What? No way. Studying abroad is for rich white girls. I can't afford to go to Italy. Really, I didn't want to go because I was scared of yet another change. Since I moved to America, my whole life had been a study abroad trip. Come on, Jimmy. Why are you being like that? We're going to go to Italy and drink wine, eat pasta, and hang out with hot Italian girls, man. Jimmy, come on. Don't be a pussy. A month later, I was sitting on a plane next to Bobby on the way to Italy. I took out an extra $20,000 in student loans, and we spent the next semester in Florence. It was yet another new start for me. But the great thing about study abroad was that I wasn't the only foreign kid. Everyone was the foreign kid. While everyone tried to get used to the new country, I'd already had a master class in assimilation. Bobby and I shared an apartment with a group of fellow study abroad students from all over the states. Tim was a fashionable gay man from Florida. Nick was a straightforward New Yorker. Josh was a streetwise chef from Wisconsin. And Alex was a half-Korean, half-white hippie from San Francisco. It was like a season of The Real World minus the hot tub. We were all from different parts of America, but we all felt like foreigners in Italy. While everyone felt like fish out of water, I felt right in my element. The Italians were not as politically correct as people in America. I passed by the Florentine flea market when I walked back to our apartment every day. The merchants peddled everything from overpriced truffle oil to miniature souvenir statues of David. It was a tourist trap, and I looked like an easy target. Every time I walked by the market, the Italian merchants would greet me with three different greetings from three different Asian languages. Konnichiwa! Ni hao! Annyeong! But they would never just say, hi, how are you in English? Then I'll turn to the merchants and say, yeah, good day to you too, sir, in perfect English. One merchant continued the charade with a bow and said, xiexie. I wanted to respond xiexie to your madre, bitch. But I restrained myself. Even though I was an American student who spoke better English than them, they still insisted I was a Chinese tourist. Assholes. Aside from a few konnichiwas from ignorant merchants, studying abroad was an absolutely amazing life-changing experience. I took classes that were barely classes. I had a wine tasting class where we got drunk on high-end wine every week, a food critic class where our homework was to eat at amazing restaurants and write about it, an architecture class where we browsed the historical Florentine sites like tourists, and a class called History of the Mafia. Yes, that was the real name of a real class, where we literally watched The Godfather Part 2 with our ex-mafioso teacher. It was more like a summer camp than school. None of those credits transferred back to my economics degree back in UCSD, but who cares? I was having the time of my life. I forgot about my near-death chewy experience and my near-deportation episode in Tijuana. Every weekend we'll visit a different city or a different country. Rome, Milan, Amsterdam, Dublin, or Barcelona. We partied at the coolest Italian nightclubs and smoked hash in front of the Santa Croce Church. Being sacrilegious had never felt so good. It was exactly what I needed to break out of my funk. I felt like the world had finally opened up, and I was no longer trapped under my Chinese family rules, my boring college curriculum, and the confines of a dreadful retirement home. It was the first time I felt the freedom of being a true American, and I had to go to Italy to find it. When I came home to the States, I felt like I was coming to America for the first time again. I'd forgotten how wide the streets were in California, and I'd forgotten how to dress like a Californian. Everyone was driving down the Pacific Coast Highway wearing t-shirts and sandals, and I was trying to walk 3 miles to the grocery store rocking an Italian blazer. The study abroad trip was such an amazing experience. It raised the bar for my standard of living. It made me not want to ever go back to my inadequate life back home. I felt a purposeful depression. I wasn't sad. I was unsatisfied. I wanted more out of life. I needed to step my life up. The Beavis and Butthead Guy. The college graduation ceremony felt more like a deadline than a celebration. It marked the day when I'll go from being a student to officially becoming an unemployed adult. Ugh, stressful. After my trip to Florence, I didn't want to settle for any mundane job like I settled for a mundane college experience. But what should I do with my life? How am I supposed to find a job if I don't even know what I want to do? I didn't even want to go to the graduation ceremony. And I was also very hungover from the night before when I tried to drink my problems away. I planned to pop Advils and just watch SportsCenter all day in bed. And then, of course, Bobby gave me no choice. Hey, Jimmy, let's go to the graduation together. Nah, I can't sit in the sun for 4 hours with a hangover. Come on, Jimmy, don't be a pussy. The guy from Beavis and Butthead is going to be the commencement speaker. It's going to be awesome. The Beavis and Butthead guy? The Beavis and Butthead guy was, of course, Mike Judge, the man who created Beavis and Butthead, King of the Hill, Office Space, and also the man who eventually created an HBO show called Silicon Valley. I watched Beavis and Butthead when I first came to America. Even though I didn't have a strong grasp on the English language yet, it made me laugh out loud with the way it was drawn and its weird sayings. I know I did what cornholio meant, but I am cornholio. I need TP for my bunghole. Was absolutely hilarious. Beavis and Butthead and The Simpsons were the only shows I watched that weren't on BET. I didn't think anybody cool ever graduated from UCSD, so I dragged my ass to the graduation ceremony with a pounding headache. Our chancellor, Marianne Fox, kicked off the commencement ceremony with a quote, "It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness." It was the lamest quote from A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens. That quote basically summed up my boring UCSD college career. I immediately started to regret coming to the ceremony. She droned on for another 5 minutes with generic inspirational remarks, and it felt like 2 hours of my massive hangover. Finally, they introduced Mike Judge. Mike looked way different than I had imagined. He was an athletic middle-aged dude with a sleekly shaved head dressed in a polished black suit. He looked more like Jason Statham in The Transporter than the guy who drew Beavis and Butthead. He came up to the microphone in front of 1,000 graduating students. He opened with the classic Butthead noise and continued in Beavis' voice. "Graduating class of 2009. Then he switched gears to the familiar Handkill voice. "Boy, I tell you what, class of 2009, it is indeed my pleasure to be with you this afternoon." Then Boomhauer came to life. "This dang old Chancellor Fox, man, this dang old, thank you very much." The crowd lit up and I forgot I had a hangover. Mike talked about how he graduated UCSD with a physics degree because that's what everyone said he should do. Mike said, "Our high school guidance counselor and adults in general had us all convinced if we just got a degree in science, jobs would just come raining out of the sky." Mike has always wanted to do comedy, but didn't think it was really possible.
After graduating, he settled for a job in Silicon Valley during the original tech boom in the 80s. He soon realized he couldn't deal with the cultish, overachieving culture in that world, so he quit and became a touring musician. He was just as lost as I was. He then stumbled into an animation studio and finally saw his dream of doing comedy materializing as a possibility.
For the first time, I was motivated. I was a man on a mission, Mike said in his speech.
Shortly after, Beavis and Butthead was born, and the rest was history. He left the job that everyone told him he should do to become one of the most successful comedic voices in America. That speech spoke to my lost, hungover college self. I couldn't imagine wasting my life away at a job based on an economics degree I never cared for in the first place. But I was too afraid to find my passion. I could hear my dad saying, "Doing what you love is how you become homeless." Finding a passion seemed as unrealistic as the Yellow Panthers winning a Grammy. Mike's commencement speech gave me the permission that my parents never gave me. It gave me the permission to quit what others thought I should do and find something I was truly passionate about. I wanted to find the thing that made me tick. And when I eventually stumbled into a comedy club, I felt that feeling of stumbling into the animation studio Mike had described in his speech. And I knew I'd found that thing I was passionate about. And as fate would have it, Mike Judge would be the one who gave me my first big break in pursuing what I loved. Mike cast me on Silicon Valley 5 years after the commencement speech, not knowing I was sitting in the audience that day. Pursue what you love, not what you should.
Chapter 5, How to Stand Up. My dad has set me up with an internship at Smith Barney, a prestigious financial consulting firm his friend worked at. I interned at the ritzy Beverly Hills office under one of their top financial advisors. It was the internship every parent dreamed of for their kids. I felt like a baller. I reconciled tax documents for their millionaire clients. I did analysis on mutual funds. And my boss handled Kevin Sorbo's finances, aka Hercules. I thought that was the coolest thing ever. Needless to say, I hadn't met a lot of celebrities before then, and I was pretty easily impressed. I had a blast during the first few weeks of the internship, daydreaming about a successful future that my dad would be so proud of. But after a month at that office, the routine set in, and an intense dread of being stuck behind a desk for the rest of my life came over me. Am I really going to be reconciling Kevin Sorbo's taxes for the rest of my fucking life? That became a recurring nightmare of mine. In the dream, I would be crunching numbers on an old Dell desktop, and Hercules would come up behind me and crack me with his whip. Faster, you mortal! Then I'll cry to the image of his diversified mutual fund portfolio. Oh, God. That still haunts me today. I started to hate everything about that internship, and I couldn't wait until my 3-month sentence was over. I hated mutual funds, I hated CNBC, and I hated Hercules. But at the same time, I knew how proud my dad was of his son who was following in his footsteps to become a financial advisor. He would ask me with a sweet sense of pride on his face, "How's the internship going?" "It's going great! Today we worked on a couple Vanguard funds." I said it with a fake stapled grin on my stupid face. I didn't have the heart to tell him I hated the internship, and I thought Vanguard funds were fucking stupid. During my last week of the internship, Dad delivered some breaking news.
"Jimmy, my friend at Smith Barney said he wants to offer you a full-time job when you graduate. Congratulations!"
I never seen him so excited. I'm sure this was one of the happiest moments of his life. But in contrast, this was one of the most dismal moments of my life. Tears of joy almost rolled down from his eyes, while tears of absolute sadness almost poured down from mine.
"Oh, yeah, that's great."
I uttered those words like a zombie. The thought of looking at mutual funds for one more day let alone for the rest of my life, made me feel dead inside. I felt like I was stuck in a terrible relationship, and I didn't know how to break up with my girlfriend who thought everything was going perfectly. Dad wanted to go out for dinner that night to celebrate.
Where do you want to go?
Anywhere you want.
Dad, listen. There was no way to let him down easily. I just had to do it. Dad, I don't want to work for Smith Barney anymore.
The joy disappeared from his face. He was in shock. He was in denial. He was blindsided. He asked me a question that he prayed I would say yes to.
Do you have another job?
No. I couldn't even make eye contact with him. He walked away, mourning the loss of his son that night. I went from a dream internship to becoming every parent's worst nightmare. My dad thought I was delusional. He was too disappointed to ever confront me face to face, so he tried to passive-aggressively get me back on track by sending me emails from CareerBuilder.com.
Jimmy, did you check your emails today?
He would say it in a deep, emotionless tone, making sure that I sense his disappointment.
No, not yet.
Check it. I sent you 3 links from CareerBuilder.com. Real people are hiring. And this happened for years to come. I couldn't imagine the torment I put my dad through those years. It was probably like having a son hooked on heroin. And he sent me CareerBuilder.com job leads instead of rehab brochures. To his credit, he never gave up on me. One could argue that not taking a legit job in order to find my passion was one of the stupidest decisions in my life. Or now in hindsight, you could say that I was brave for making such a risky decision. But for me, it wasn't even a decision. Taking a chance was the only way I could live with myself. I'd rather take a chance and fail miserably than to have never tried at all. Low Ball Jim. What made you get into stand-up comedy? Many people have asked me that question, and I can never give them a rosy answer that'll satisfy them. I've heard other comedians answer that question with a beautiful life story. I used to sneak into the movie theater and watch Eddie Murphy's Raw with my brother, and it changed my life. From that day on, my only goal in life was to become a stand-up comedian. And the day my brother passed away with a congenital heart disease, I went on stage to my very first open mic. Beautiful. But who gives a shit? I'm not afraid to disappoint people and answer the question with the simple truth. So what made you get into stand-up comedy? I was fucking desperate. I was 21 years old when I did my first open mic. 21 was supposed to be the prime of my life where I partied every night, did ecstasy, and had unadulterated sex with hot strangers. Instead, I was stewing away in my dad's apartment playing Madden with Phil during my last summer of vacation from college. I couldn't accept this as my reality, especially after coming back from Florence. Look, Phil's an awesome dude. But the thought of playing PlayStation in my dad's apartment for the rest of my life gave me an anxiety attack. I wanted to party like Mike the Situation on Jersey Shore. I wanted to live! I needed to expand my horizon and find a community of friends. So I decided to sign up for a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu class because I was a fan of the UFC. But I totally forgot people actively try to break each other's arms in that sport. In my very first jiu-jitsu class, the Brazilian instructor mounted on top of me and demonstrated a guillotine choke in front of the whole class. Before I could tap out in submission, the front of my esophagus was pressed against the back of my spine and I almost passed out. I thought he had cracked my windpipe. Luckily, I only had a sore throat for 2 weeks. People always tell you, never give up. Don't be a quitter. Those people have never gotten choked out by Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt. I should have quit halfway through day one, but like a good idiot who believed in old idioms, I stuck with it for 3 painful months. They would always team me up with girls during sparring exercises because I was the smallest guy in the class. What's the fun in this? I thought to myself. I'll have to take it easy on the girls. But I soon realized that the girls were actually much stronger than I was
and they twisted me up like the kid working at Wetzel's Pretzel. Once I was paired with a really attractive blonde girl. It sounded awesome on paper, but it turned out to be my most embarrassing jiu-jitsu experience yet. Before I could even think about flirting with her, she tucked my head under her shoulders and put me in the oh-so-familiar guillotine choke. The rest of the class looked on as my face turned blue. I barely managed to tap out before I passed out. Then, we'll start again, and I'll get caught in another submission. 5 minutes into this utter humiliation, things got even worse. I got a boner. This rare physical contact with the opposite sex was way more action than I'd gotten in a year. Instead of looking like a pervert with a BDSM fetish, I immediately tapped out before she could notice my boner. I was TKO'd by my own dick. I rushed over to grab my gym bag to cover up my boner and then sidestepped out of the gym. I never went back ever again. The only female contact I'd gotten lately was getting my ass handed to me in jiu-jitsu. I was destined to be unemployed and play Madden with Phil in my dad's apartment for the rest of my life. And that's when I googled local open mics. When people google local open mics, they're one step away from googling, what's the least painful way to kill myself? It's the last frontier before giving up on life. My search results led me to the Ha Ha Comedy Club in North Hollywood. It was the only legitimate comedy club in LA that had an open mic every night at 6 before their real shows at 8 o'clock. The catch was, I had to pay $5 to get 5 minutes of stage time, only to perform in front of 5 other open micers who were impatiently waiting their own turn. Sounds terrible? It totally was. But as bad as it was still better than wasting my life away. My life was so lame at that point that paying money to embarrass myself in an open mic was somehow an improvement. Almost every comedian I've met started doing stand-up after some kind of crisis in his or her life. Sometimes it's a bad divorce, a bankruptcy, or a third DUI arrest. For me, it was getting a boner at a jiu-jitsu class. The next day, I drove to the Ha Ha Comedy Club and paid my $5 to get on stage for the very first time. I wasn't nervous at all. I mean, what did I have to lose? My dignity? That was left behind long ago on that jiu-jitsu mat. So many of my favorite urban comedians and all of my favorite rappers went by stage names. Cedric the Entertainer, Bruce Bruce, Snoop Dogg, Jay-Z. I thought I needed my own catchy stage name. So I signed up on my first open mic as Lowball Jim. I'd seen that name in a Texas Hold'em instructional guide online where there were 2 players facing off, Highball Phil and Lowball Jim. I thought it would be funny to get introduced as a shady-sounding Lowball Jim and this little innocent-looking Asian kid would pop up. And our next comedian, Lowball Jim. I jumped on stage and got my first chuckles. What's up, North Hollywood? I learned that from BET Comic View. Always start by shouting out the city you're in. The crowd responded with a few mechanical claps, and by crowd, I mean the 5 other comedians who were waiting their turn to get on stage. I then rambled on with 5 minutes of masturbation jokes, the gold standard of all new comics who haven't learned the meaning of the word hack. And my closer was yet another masturbation bit. So I was jerking off to porn on my computer and watching ESPN at the same time. And right when I was about to finish, Michael Vick scores a touchdown and I turned around to the TV and I came. So basically, I jacked off to Michael Vick. With a few pity chuckles, the legend of Lowball Jim was born. All the comedians hung out at the bar after the shows and talked about our sets. Everyone was giving each other tips for their bits. It reminded me of writing rhymes at Chris's house. A fellow open micer came up to me. Yo, that Michael Vick bit was funny, yo. Can I give you a tag? I didn't know what tag meant, but sure. Apparently, tags are additional funny lines tagged after the punchline. So, at the end of the bit, you can say, so now every time Michael Vick scores a touchdown, I come a little. I laughed. That was fucking brilliant. I didn't think anyone would care for the stupid Michael Vick jerk-off joke. But this guy was actually analyzing it and helping me improve it. I felt like I was welcome into a secret society of comedians. This new world with jerking off to Michael Vick was considered an art form was exactly what I was looking for. Even though stand-up was a one-man sport, it was a community of hilarious people. There were comedians from every background. Black, white, Asian, Latinos, 20s, 50s, rich, poor, single, divorced, red-blooded Americans, and immigrants. Comedy doesn't care where you come from. It cares about how funny you are. Comedians are some of the most cynical and judgmental people, but we judge each other on the content of our jokes, not the color of our skin. Martin Luther King would be proud of that. As long as you're funny, it doesn't matter if you're rich or poor, Nigerian or Chinese, skinny or fat, funny is funny. Stand-up comedy is one of the only places where all the outsiders truly fit in. It is like a secret society for the disenfranchised. It's the only place where the weirder you are, the more interesting you become. Stand-up comedy was one of the only places I felt like I truly belonged. The Godfather. When I went back to San Diego to finish my shameful fifth year of college, I went to every comedy club in San Diego and hoped for some stage time. And everyone told me, if you want to do stand-up in San Diego, you need to talk to Sean Kelly. Who is this mysterious Sean Kelly character? Is he a comedy club owner? Is he Dave Chappelle's cousin? Everyone seemed to know him, but nobody wanted to tell me where to find him. I needed to hunt him down if I wanted to be a part of this San Diego comedy scene. I went home and did some research on Sean Kelly. Through a Google search, I found that Sean was the owner of a public speaker agency where you could hire anyone from Bill Clinton to Scottie Pippen. I was enamored by all the celebrities I saw on that website. Remember, at that point, the only celebrity I knew was Kevin Sorbo. Then I saw Sean was performing at the Comedy Palace in San Diego that weekend, so I went down there and stalked down this mystery man. I told the doorman at the Comedy Palace I was a comedian, and he let me in right away, free of charge. That's the secret to any comedy club. Just say you're a comedian, and they'll let you right in. And if you say you're industry, meaning an agent or a manager, the doorman might actually pay you to come in. Everyone in a comedy club wants to get signed. It's like the training ground for desperate artists. I finally got my first glimpse of Sean when the host introduced him. He was an unassuming middle-aged bald white guy who definitely wasn't Dave Chappelle's cousin. But he was funny as hell. I waited for him backstage like an excited fangirl at a Justin Bieber concert. Finally, he walked past me and I saw my chance to introduce myself. Hi, Sean. I saw you owned a public speaker agency. So how does that work? And just like a mob boss, Sean said, take a seat. My research paid off. He started dropping some serious knowledge on me. He told me, the speaker agency is a side thing I started. You can make money doing stand-up, but you can make a lot of money being a public speaker. We should all do both. Comedians don't think about that. We are already great public speakers. Sean was a master businessman. I learned that the Comedy Palace was actually a Greek restaurant during the day called the Greek Palace. Business was slow at the Greek Palace, so Sean convinced its owner to let him run a comedy show there at night. Eventually, that turned into a full-fledged comedy club with its own staff. Sean told me, instead of begging for stage time at other comedy clubs, I started my own club. When other comics were talking about jerking off, Sean was talking about business plans. Whenever Sean talked, he captured your full, undivided attention. Some people can sell ice to an Eskimo. Sean can sell a Home Depot utility belt to Batman. And his ultimate gift was helping others discover their story. Where are you from? Sean asked me. Oh, I went to high school in L.A., but I was born in Hong Kong. How old were you when you came to L.A.? I was 13. I couldn't really speak English yet, so I learned how to speak English by watching BET. I jokingly told him the truth. Sean didn't laugh, but he took it all in. See, that's what you need to talk about in your stand-up. You have a great story, and you have a different point of view. Talk about that in your set. Then once you have all your stories written down,
You can even write a book.
And here I am, writing that book. I never met anyone who had such a high-caliber creative motor within a clever business mind. I hung on to everything Sean said. He became my mentor and my comedy godfather. Along with his many talents, Sean was also a licensed auctioneer. He did charity auctions, police impound auctions, and storage unit auctions. He'll later use his skills to pitch the reality show Storage Hunters, where he played the auctioneer. To many in the U.S., Storage Hunters might be the lesser-known version of Storage Wars, but Storage Hunters eventually became one of the biggest reality shows in the U.K. Sean and his wife, Lori, would eventually move to the U.K., where strangers stopped them every two steps to take a selfie. Not only was he selling out shows as a comedian, he had made himself a celebrity in the U.K. We've become family over the years. Lori once asked Sean, "Hey, Sean, can we just adopt Jimmy?" And Sean said, "I'm pretty sure Jimmy has real parents, and he's way past his prime adoption age." First job in showbiz. The Comedy Palace became my new hangout. It became the fraternity that I never had at UCSD. We had 100 new people coming to watch our sets every night, and we drank on the house. We even had a waitress that used to work as a stripper at Cheetah's. I mean, what more can you ask for in a fraternity? I was hanging out at the Comedy Palace so much, they eventually hired me as the doorman. I seated the audience members in exchange for 10 minutes of stage time and 2 hours of minimum wage pay. It was always a challenge to seat the audience and then try to be funny on stage. Everyone in the audience was asking themselves, "Hey, isn't that the kid who sat us? I guess they're just letting everyone on stage here now. Anyone can do stand-up. Even the door guy." I took on the challenge. It was so much sweeter when I made them laugh after they thought I was just a doorman. I got paid $15 a night as the doorman, but I got paid nothing for my sets as a comedian. I was just happy to get some legitimate stage time that wasn't an open mic. One of my favorite comedians at the Palace was Terrell Wright. Terrell was a hilarious black dude from Detroit. His brother Kool-Aid was a famous urban comedian that used to be on BET Comic View. Needless to say, I looked up to him. Terrell was so funny that nobody really wanted to follow him on stage, so he always went up last at the Comedy Palace shows. He was just as funny offstage as he was on stage. He'll always give me old-school player dating advice that his dad had passed on to him. "Hey, Jimmy, if you fuck her mine, you can fuck her all the time." I didn't even know what that meant, but it sounded cool as hell. Then there was Guam Felix, who's literally from the U.S. territory of Guam. Imagine if my name was Hong Kong Jim. That would actually sound way more gangster than Lowball Jim. Guam was a 40-year-old veteran comedian who was a former strip club DJ. His goal in life was winning the lottery. He would preface everything with, "When I win the lottery..." But he didn't even have ambitious goals for if he did win the lottery. He'll always tell me, "When I win the lottery, dog, we all go in the hometown buffet, man." And I'm like, "Guam, you don't have to win $50 million to go to hometown buffet. It's $11.99 over there." "Yeah, but then we can go every day, dog." Terrell once said to me, "Guam is the ghettoest motherfucker I've ever known." That speaks volumes coming from a guy who grew up in the hood in Detroit. All of the comedians helped out at the club. Every week we folded envelopes with promotional mailers in the back room of the Comedy Palace. I never minded the extra work. I got to hang out with some of the most hilarious people in the city. We were late on sending the promotion mailers one week, and all the comedians stayed up to pull an all-nighter in the back of the palace. Terrell, Guam, and I, along with five other comedians, were tediously folding envelopes like a bunch of Chinese sweatshop workers. It was 4 a.m, and we're trying our best to keep each other awake. Guam asked Terrell, "Hey, T, how many girls you slept with, dog?" Terrell tried to do some math in his head, but quickly gave up. "I don't even know. Either he had amnesia, or it was way too many for him to count. I couldn't imagine a day where I would lose count of the women I slept with. At that time, I could count on one hand. Honestly, I could have counted with one finger." Guam continued. Oh, I'll guess it's probably around the same number as me.
Terrell said, probably. How many for you?
Without skipping a beat, Guam answered, 160? Half of them were strippers when I DJed at the strip club.
Holy shit! Is that even a possible number? I've never even talked to 160 women, and definitely not 80 strippers. My mind couldn't comprehend such an astronomical number.
What was even more surprising was that this seemed completely normal to everyone else. Nobody flinched or asked any further questions. They just nodded in agreement.
Terrell calmly acquiesced.
Yeah, that sounds about right. So I kept my mouth shut and acted like everything was normal, while my brain melted with shock and envy.
Guam then turned to Robert, a shyish comedian on the other side of the table. Yo, Robert, what about you, dog?
Okay, maybe Guam and Terrell are just crazy. I'm glad to hear a normal guy like Robert's perspective. Given that he was 40 and fairly handsome, I was guessing like 8.
Man, I lost count after like 60.
What the fuck? Robert too?
Guam casually pressed on.
It's gotta be over 3 digits though, right?
Yeah, I think around there. I don't know. One time a girl came up to me and said, hey, remember me? And I had no idea who she was. Apparently, I had sex with her before.
Huh.
Did everyone have sex with 100 women but me?
Everyone laughed as Guam reached over the table to give Robert a high five. I sat there, shell-shocked.
For me, the thought of having sex with 100 women was like thinking about the vastness of the universe. It's unfathomable for a meager human brain.
And just then, Guam pivoted to me.
Jimmy, what about you, dog?
I looked up at him in a confused panic, like a soldier who was holding his own severed arm in Saving Private Ryan.
Me? I stalled. I pretended to count in my head.
Guam started laughing.
What, like 6?
Everyone cracked up.
Yo, 6 is 6 times more than my real number. And they're laughing at that?
I broke out in a cold sweat. My number was so off, I didn't even know how to lie. I just nodded and agreed.
Yeah, something like that.
Yo, we gotta get Jimmy laid, Guam screamed out.
And Terrell said, shit, Jimmy don't even know what pussy is yet.
That night, I feel like I needed to crawl under my bed and reevaluate my entire life and have a real heart-to-heart with my penis. I wanted to be cool like Guam. Even though he was dreaming to win the lottery, I looked up to his sexual prowess. Hong Kong Jim wanted to be a DJ in a strip club just like Guam Felix. Stand-up comedy was my first experience with the real world after being institutionalized in school my entire life. What's normal in the stand-up comedy world was far from normal in the real world. Going to sleep at 3 in the morning, waking up at noon, and dreaming of becoming a strip club DJ. Even though I knew something was off about this world, I wanted to fit in with my frat brothers. The Comedy Palace was my only escape from my lousy real life, and I was loving every moment in this alternate universe. I'll show up during the day to take reservations on the phone, seat the audience in the evening, and then fold envelopes at night. If they had let me sleep there, I would have moved into the Comedy Palace. I even brought my Xbox to the back room. I'll call Terrell during the afternoon, 5 hours before the show.
Yo, T, wanna come get your ass kicked in NBA 2K?
I'll see you in the club, bitch.
You guys need to look at the PDF of this. I looked super shady back then with a hat and like a really thin mustache, and there's a picture of me, Guam, and Terrell.
Reality always strikes when you're having too much fun. I was finally finding some meaning to my life at the Comedy Palace, but I soon realized my $60 weekly paycheck wasn't paying the bills. I was living way below the poverty line, even for a comedian. I ate instant ramen with a 99-cent can of Vienna sausage 5 nights out of the week. I'll save up enough money to go to either Denny's or pick out at Hometown Buffet once a month. Maybe Guam was right about trying to win the lottery. I was praying for a car to plow into me so I could get some insurance settlement. And maybe my dad was right all along. Pursuing your dreams is for losers. Doing what you love is how you become homeless.
I approached one of the managers at the Comedy Palace about my dire financial situation, hoping he'll give me a raise from $7.50 to $8 an hour. Jimmy, look, you're great, but there are plenty of other desperate comedians out there who would kill for minimum wage, he frankly explained to me. And he was right. I had zero leverage on asking for a 50-cent raise. Then he advised, why don't you ask around for a second job? All the comedians here have day jobs.
I don't know. I don't think anybody wants to hire me, my low self-esteem responded.
Then Mike said, dude, everyone loves you here. Just ask the next person who comes in the door. And just like a trite sitcom plot, the door swung open, and Jay, a middle-aged comedian, entered. I turned to him. Jay, where do you work?
Oh, I sell used cars.
Can I get a job with you?
Yeah, sure. Come on down to the lot. I'll get you a job.
And just like that, I became a comedian slash used car salesman. Apparently, you need zero qualifications to become a used car salesman, just like becoming a stand-up comedian. The dealership was a crummy used car lot that specialized in selling shitty old cars to people with bad credit. Our customers' credit scores were so bad, when no other car lot in the city would even sell them a tricycle, that's when we would jump in and sell them a 1998 Dodge Neon at 24% interest rate. It doesn't take a master salesman to sell to people on their last resort. Our slogan was, either you buy our shitty car or take the bus. The car lot manager, Larry, was a 60-year-old veteran car salesman and a career alcoholic. He would vanish from the lot for days at a time to go on a binge. Then he would make a miraculous comeback from the dead and push 10 Dodge Neons in 1 week. I never judged Larry based on his addiction, and I looked up to him as a top-notch car pusher. I learned a lot of old-school salesmanship from Larry, and I soon became the young hotshot at the shittiest car lot in town. It might not have been Smith Barney, but I felt like a baller who could finally afford hometown buffet once a week. I knew if I worked hard, someday, just maybe, I'll be able to afford Red Lobster.
How to handle racist hecklers. Getting on stage was a tremendous high, and I was hooked. For a fleeting moment when I was on stage, I was able to forget about all my life's problems and be truly in the moment. I've seen comedians trade money, weed, and even sexual favors for stage time. If stand-up is your addiction, stage time is your crack. During my first 2 years of stand-up, I did 7 to 10 sets a week, and I didn't get paid for a single one of those early sets. I would do any type of show, at any venue, in any situation. I've done stand-up at a nursing home before bingo night, and I performed at a children's party where I had to compete with Spider-Man for their attention. My friend who ran a bar in San Diego asked me to do his Monday night stand-up show at the bar. It's a fun show. The crowd's a little rowdy, but it's a good crowd. You should come do it. Well, I needed a hit of that crack. It was a particularly seedy dive bar in the south side of San Diego. All the patrons drove lifted pickup trucks, wore cargo shorts, and drank Bud Light. When he told me the crowd was a little rowdy, what he actually meant was that the crowd was a bunch of drunk, racist assholes. I don't like to toss around the word racist lightly. But in this instance, it was quite justified. Before I went on stage that night, someone in the crowd booed, and another comedian and the rest of the crowd cheered. Then another drunk dude in the audience heckled, "You suck!" The comedian was flustered. Then another heckler randomly screamed out, "Nigger!" What? The heckle made no sense. The comedian was white. This piece of human trash just thought it was funny to scream out a nasty racial slur. What's even worse was that the crowd loved it. They cheered in agreement. I couldn't believe it. I thought to myself, well, tonight is the night I die. I badly wanted the stage time, though. I was willing to dangle my little Asian body in front of a bunch of racist fools who looked like gator wranglers from the show Swamp People. I knew I had to do something different than my normal material to survive that night, so I decided to take a chance. Right before it was my turn to go on stage, I went over to the DJ,
who was actually just some local drunk with an iPod, and I asked him to play a particular song for when I get on stage. When the host brought me up, "Okay, give it up for our next comedian," the song came on. Everybody was kung fu fighting. Those kicks were fast as lightning. Our producer told me we can't sing that because of copyright rules, but I think you guys all know which song that is. The crowd busted up in laughter. I jumped onto the stage and screamed into the microphone, "What's up, you racist motherfuckers?" I was either going to win them over or get stabbed in the back of my neck. I might have pissed myself a little bit, but I didn't let it show on my face. Then the whole place erupted into laughter. I got them by the balls, and they paid attention to the rest of my set like a bunch of studious honor students. I doubled down on the material about being Chinese, and they loved it. I can't go to Chinese restaurants with white people anymore. I proclaimed in front of a room full of the whitest people. Every time I go to a Chinese restaurant, my white friends always ask me, "Jimmy, you speak Mandarin? Bro, order in Mandarin. It's going to be hilarious. They're going to hook us up." I stared at my imaginary white friend. "Bro, we're in Panda Express. Her name tag says Consuela." The crowd ate it up like it was orange chicken with a side of chow mein. I went on to have one of my best sets yet. I didn't get paid a single penny that night, but I did score a six-pack Bud Light. There were no rules in stand-up. It was the opposite of college. This was all the creative freedom I'd ever wanted. I lived and breathed stand-up, and all I could think about was how to improve my bits. It made me forget I was a total disappointment to my dad. This was the burning passion that Mike Judge described in his commencement speech when he found animation. It was clear that I finally found my calling in stand-up comedy. Top 5 non-monetary payments for a stand-up set. Weed. High fives. Unsolicited career advice. One food item from the left side of the menu. A used copy of FIFA 2013. I got Arsenio canceled. 6 years later, I made my stand-up debut on TV on the revival of the Arsenio Hall Show. Growing up on urban culture, performing in front of Dog Pound on the Arsenio Hall Show was the equivalent of me performing on Johnny Carson's The Tonight Show. The guest performances were usually booked months in advance, but I got an urgent call from the booker on a Wednesday. "Hey, a comedian dropped out of Friday's show. Do you want to do it?" Abso-fucking-lutely. I had 2 days to prepare and no time to overthink it. I wanted to look fresh for my debut, so I went to Nordstrom with a $500 limit on my credit card. The show was going to send a limo to pick me up. I couldn't just hop in my Ross basketball shorts. I'd never bought anything at the normal Nordstrom before. I could barely afford Nordstrom Rack. I bought a $200 pair of jeans and a nice polo shirt at full retail price. I could hear my mom having a heart attack. "Jimmy, you spent a $200 on those jeans? Are you crazy? I can buy you 5 pairs in China for $10. The old country guilt still ran deep in my DNA, but I wanted to feel like an American baller for once in my life. When the limo picked me up from my crummy apartment that Friday afternoon, my confused neighbors probably thought I was going to a high school prom. I arrived at the studio, and I was ushered into my very own green room. I realized how far I'd come from folding envelopes in the back of the Comedy Palace to the Arsenio Hall Show. The show had just started, and I was scheduled to be the closing performance. Arsenio was doing his thing, riling up the Dog Pound with his opening monologue. His first guest was Tom Bergeron, the host of Dancing with the Stars and America's Funniest Home Videos, who I grew up watching with my family back home in China. It was surreal to be watching the show on a TV backstage, knowing that I'll be teleported onto that television set in just a few minutes. I was a nervous wreck. I chugged as many free Fiji water bottles as I could in the green room to make up for my $200 jeans. A production assistant knocked on the door. "You're on in 5. I took a much-needed pee, and I walked backstage. It was surreal when Arsenio introduced me to the Dog Pound. "Give it up for Jimmy O. Yang, ladies and gentlemen." Wow, Arsenio Hall, the urban Johnny Carson, now knows my name. I walked out to an uproar.